You're listening to Face Off, episode 78, recorded July 19th, 2010. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And this is the podcast where we talk about lots of different things involving web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com. Oh, so coming in via Skype again this week, Mark, how is the icicle doing?
The icicle is doing fine. I think it's serving its purpose well. So it saved me from having to buy a very expensive mixer to do the remote, you know, recordings. So
blue stuff is good. I mean, I'm very satisfied with like the blue eyeball I have, which is their Snowball, which is a webcam or a small high quality microphone. But the eyeball is like the Snowball. It has like a little webcam you can pop up, which is very cool. Anyways, blue is good stuff.
Is that the one that's like room? What do they call that? The
omnidirectional?
Yeah.
No, this is not omnidirectional. I'm pretty sure it's cardioid, which is sort of the standard microphone pattern for microphones. So microphones, when you get into nicer ones in general, they sort of have a pattern, which is, you know, if the microphone sits here, what are sort of the optimum directions around it for collecting sound? So an omnidirectional clearly would be able to pick up sound from all directions really easily. Cardioid has kind of a big lump right and directly in front of it, and then kind of a smaller lump behind it. That's kind of a cardioid pattern, and there's several different types of patterns and stuff. But
so Omni would be good for like interviews and stuff.
Yeah, Omni is really good for that sort of thing. Like if you're doing a conference call or something, or recording, you know, recording a group of speakers, like a town council meeting or something, where you need good audio from all directions. So like, for example, for a podcast, a cardioid pattern is perfect because right now I want to lessen the other sounds around me. I want just my voice. You know, I don't want the less noise coming from around the room, the better. So that's why we use cardioid pattern. Anyways, there's a little microphone knowledge for everybody. Let's get into our news and follow-ups. This one comes to us from Philip Downer, which is a guy here in Bozeman that we both know. You can get to him by going to his Twitter handle, ManifestPhil. And he asked us a question about LESS, which is, what is it? It's like a CSS framework, kind of.
It's if you're familiar with Sass or Haml, isn't it comparable to that?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the whole idea is to write less, and it does the same thing.
Yeah.
As like normal standard markup.
Right. So, I mean, I've used Sass. I've talked about Sass. I really like Sass. Sass is a lot like LESS, especially the new version of Sass that just came out. And the whole idea is it makes CSS a little more flexible. It makes it a little bit more like a real programming language. As CSS is right now, it's definitely just sort of a straightforward, you know, markup. I tell you what each object in my HTML does, and that's about it. It doesn't have things like variables or any sort of advanced mix-in ability or anything like that. And these frameworks that have come out now aim to sort of fill that void. Like, wouldn't it be nice at the top of your CSS file to set a variable called, like, you know, you get your palette for your website and you set a variable called, like, this is red, right? There is already a CSS variable for red, but it's a very bright red. Let's say you say, I want red to be this, or I want Jade Robbins orange to be this particular color. And then as you go through your CSS, when you label something, you just say, I want this to be Jade Robbins orange. And so if you ever decide to change that color, you just change the variable at the top, right? It'd be really nice if CSS could do that. So these tools, these sort of CSS plus pluses, aim to give you a little more functionality like that. LESS is one of them. I'm more familiar with Sass. But so here's the interesting thing with LESS that Phil wanted us to talk about is the newest version of LESS. It's been a Ruby gem for a long time, written for Ruby. There may have been implementations in other languages, but it's been a Ruby project. They just announced that their next version is going to be JavaScript.
Like they're porting it, or is this going to be an add-on? Like it's
no, they're totally rewriting it. LESS will be a JavaScript product. It will no longer be a Ruby gem.
Oh wow! So kind of what does that mean? I mean,
well, so as it is now, and I guess we can get into like our thoughts into it later. But as it is now, like you only could use it with Ruby. You wrote it, and you got like a Rails Gem or Rails plugin for it or something. And then when, you know, your Rails site would run, it would compile the lesson to CSS. Now it's going to be JavaScript. So you write your file and I don't know how the internals work, but I'm assuming that the JavaScript goes through your less file and either writes or modifies your CSS to be the way it would have been if it had been compiled and spit out via Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
Because JavaScript has access to all that, has access to all your CSS, and it could do that.
So my concern with that, sounds great. Like I am a fan of Haml and Sass, and I like, at least especially Haml, writing, you know, smaller pieces of code that basically do the same thing, and having the functionality to have variables where I can say red is this. Are there any downsides for having it JavaScript? I mean, doesn't that mean that the browser has to do some work before the CSS is displayed properly?
Exactly. It is. It's going to have client-side processing, which means it means a lot of things. So, for example, if you use it in Ruby, it gets, when you start your server, however your Ruby process gets started, that's when it compiles it. It finds the less files and compiles it then. And mm-hmm. So then you have actual CSS files, you know, so your browser just requests a normal CSS file. Nothing has to happen. Now, I'm assuming what will happen is the JavaScript will either load the less file I didn't look into the new implementation deep enough, but either way, there has to be client-side processing. The client is taking it and doing something to it, which, I mean, depending upon what you're doing or how it's written, it could have a performance impact.
That the browser doesn't work with that,
you know, that's another thing too, is if you have JavaScript disabled or something, if it's not compliant with mobile browsers, people won't be able to see your styles, which can be a problem.
But then again
the benefit is now it's no longer trapped in Ruby land. I mean, if you want to use it with PHP, if you want to use it with static HTML, you could.
Yeah, so I mean, this could be used with PHP or ASP.NET or Python or pretty much anything. I mean, because JavaScript is universal, really.
Yeah, exactly. It's not, you know, it doesn't matter what happens on the back end, it's still on the client side, and JavaScript can handle it. I don't think I would use the JavaScript client side version, but I think it's a really cool step towards taking these tools that are, very language specific and you can't really share it and kind of making it, you know, useful. And I think we're going to see just a lot more stuff being done in JavaScript anyways. So it's kind of sort of the way of the future, I think.
Yeah, I'm curious. They must have some sort of fallback. Like if the browser doesn't support it or whatever, it can still, I don't know, maybe you have the option to generate a CSS, like an actual CSS that could fall back, or I'm not sure. There's got to be something though, right? You'd think.
So here's the thing: is less is not like SAS, in that SAS is the old version of SAS, anyways, is a language that would not be valid CSS. I think less is valid CSS. The things it doesn't understand, it just skips over. And so actually the same thing is true of the new version of SAS. Any SAS 3 is valid CSS.
So, interesting.
So it may be one of these things that if you you will have styles, but they won't be perfect, or they may not be right, but you'll have styles, or, you know, I'm not sure. I really don't know enough about less. I'm more interested, you know, it's like this crazy thing of this Ruby project getting completely rewritten in JavaScript, and it's kind of crazy that people are moving that direction.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So who knows? Who knows what we'll see made out of CSS in the future, or out of CSS, out of JavaScript in the future. I'm a fan of anything that makes it easier to write CSS, because it is clearly lacking a couple of things that make it very difficult to use.
Well, it's clear from all the projects we're seeing, like Haml and Sass, that people are tired of writing the same code over
Absolutely.
And over.
And, I mean, we definitely notice these sort of things. So that's the news and follow-ups. If you have any thoughts or anything, or any thoughts or comments on this, go ahead and hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or email us. We're curious to hear what you guys think of it, too, because it's kind of cool. I think it's a new thing we're going to start seeing happen a lot more. So let's get into our geek tools of the week. Plural, we actually have a couple. This is an idea that came again from Philip Downer. He was very productive this week in helping out Face Off Show. So thank you, Phil. We appreciate it. The geek tool this week, the first one is the Blue Lounge cable drop. And this is all about getting those, you know, a lot of times we have laptops, we have all kinds of things on our desk, iPod cables, and they are kind of a wreck sometimes because they, you know, they'll fall behind the desk, or you got to keep them coiled up on your desk, and that makes, you know, cables everywhere, and it gets very frustrating. The Blue Lounge cable drop is a sort of a little rubber pincher sort of that you stick to your desk and then you put your cable through it. So it's small enough that the cable can actually slide in and out, but the plug can't. So, you know, if you take that, your power cable from your laptop and unplug it real quick, and normally it would, you know, sort of slither off the desk and fall behind it. When the, you know, the power end gets to the little pincher, it stops and is right there for you.
You know, the reason I broke my last setup for my mic was because I was kind of standing on some cables near my computer, because I always have to switch my my sound from my Linux computer to my Windows one all the time. And if I had like a cable thing where I could just have it on the side of the desk, I wouldn't probably have broken it. So this is definitely one of those things that would be very handy.
Right. And so these Blue Lounge ones, they're really nice. They have like two sets. They have sort of a muted color set, which is like sort of a gray and a white and then a light brown. And then they have like these crazy color set, which is like purple and pink and stuff like that. We have a link to one in the show notes. Check it out. But, you know, if you, let's say you don't care if it looks really pretty or not, we actually found another alternative made by our friends at 3M. There's the 3M cord organizer pack, which is really cool about this. They use that 3M command adhesive, which I don't know if you've ever used anything with that before. It's really cool. You like stick it to your wall and there's like a tiny tab sticking up at the top. And so if you've ever used like those foam adhesive things to your wall before, you know how dangerous they are when you go to take them off. Either they leave foam crap everywhere or you rip off, you know, the paper from your drywall. It's just terrible. Yeah. The command adhesive has like revolutionized that in that it's super sticky, but all you start doing is you pull that tab on the bottom and it starts releasing the adhesive and it comes right off. It's freaking cool. The 3M ones don't look quite as nice and cute as the other ones, but they're a way to stick something to your desk and cinch up your cables to it and keep it nice and clean.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, I mounted some speakers using 3M stuff, and I like tested it because I didn't want the speakers to fall. I was very nervous because they're kind of expensive, and so I hung a gallon of water from it for like a week, and so those things can hold like 8 pounds, like no problem. They're pretty sticky.
Yeah, so check it out. We've got the Blue Lounge cable drops and the 3M command adhesive organizer packs. The links are in the show notes. Clean up your cables. I think I'm going to get some of so the 3M ones are kind of nice for so the Blue Lounge ones are good for like a laptop or things that you plug in and unplug a lot, you know. But the 3M ones are pretty good for like cables that you have around all the time. So I might grab a couple of those and stick them around my new desk so that I don't have my cables dangling. Check them out. So if, oh no, hey, we got web apps to go to. Let's get into our web apps this week. The first web app I want to talk about is a little web app called Glowdart.
Glowdart.
Yeah, say that five times.
What is Glowdart?
Glowdart is like, it's a web app that's like a big giant news ticker. So if you ever have like a second monitor that doesn't get much action, or you know, you have like your cell phone, like your Droid and your dock or something like that, and you kind of feel lame that it's just sitting there doing nothing, this is like a good website, because what it does is it lets you pick which sort of news sources you want in your ticker, and it just kind of sits and ticks, you know, news stories or YouTube videos or Hulu videos sort of off on the side for you. You can customize which sources you want, you can pause it if you want to. But it's sort of just designed to be something on a second monitor or on something there. If you have like a screen that isn't getting much action, put it on there and it'll keep it moving, give you lots of news to tick about.
And so you can put your own feeds and stuff in here?
You can hook it up to Facebook or Twitter, which will put some of your stuff in there, but I don't think you can just insert any feed into it.
I see. That's pretty cool. Like, yeah, like you said, if you have another monitor and you just want to let the news tick by.
Exactly. And there's like, there's two themes. You can get a light or a dark one. So if you don't want this big, bright second screen glowing in your face all night, you can switch to the dark theme. One of those really simple, really big, you know, big text, big fonts, you know, so that's easy and quick to read. Really simple, fun web app. Kind of reminds me of like the Fave 4 that we reviewed a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't require a login or anything like that. If you want to connect it to Twitter and to Facebook so you can stream your stuff there, that's okay, but you don't have to. You know, it stores all the settings in a cookie. Really easy, really cool to use. Check it out. It's at glowdart.com. So the next web app we want to talk about is, I'm a pretty big geek. I don't know about you, Mark. One thing I've loved forever is 8-bit video games. The Nintendo was one of my first gaming systems ever. And I just love 8-bit music. I listen to sort of like 8-bit, you know, remixes of like 8-bit techno and stuff that, you know, is like really modern, but sort of an 8-bit theme through it and stuff. I love that kind of music. And this web app, this next web app really kind of feeds that obsession. This is the 8-bit collective. You can get to it by going to 8bc.org. And it's just a big collection of 8-bit music.
These are like the originals, not the techno versions, or both, or...
You know, it seems to have anything dealing with 8-bit. I don't, you know, what I was listening to was just sort of 8-bit music. I'm not sure if it has sort of the 8-bit techno-y stuff, but it just is, it's got a constant theme of 8-bit in it.
I always like the Contra ones and Mega Man and different ones.
You know, there's like a couple of those classic, if you played a video game long enough, I actually downloaded the Ninja Gaiden, maybe, I don't know how to pronounce it, soundtrack from the original NES, and I know every song in that thing because I played that game so much.
And but here's one, the Sonic the Hedgehog 2 Casino Night Zone.
Oh, I remember that song. Yeah. I play a lot of Sonic the Hedgehog 2. In fact, I got a Game Gear specifically for that game. But
Super Mario. It's good stuff here. And it looks like they even have 8-bit of
So there's remixes
popular
here.
Songs too, not just Nintendo games.
Really?
Yeah.
So like here is a Ultra Dance Adagio for a remix. So it had, I mean, it's anything 8-bit. So there are remixes, like techno remixes with 8-bit stuff in it. There is just straight 8-bit songs. You know, there's a couple, I can't even remember the name of them right now, but there's a couple good radio stations, like Shoutcast stations out there with some good 8-bit music. I like it. It's just a thing in my childhood, so...
Is Don't Stop Believing NES remake? I want to listen to that.
Yeah, I wish I could have heard that while I was playing Ninja Gaiden. I bet I would have beat it then. I still haven't beat it. When we got a Wii and Ninja Gaiden came out as a virtual console title for it, so I thought, oh man, this is gonna be great. I'm an adult now, right? When I was a kid, I couldn't beat that game because I was a kid and I was stupid. But I'm an adult now. I can totally beat this game. Still haven't beat it. It's so hard. It's just ridiculous.
You know, Mega Man is a really hard game sometimes, too.
Oh, man. Even the new one. So it's way hard. Can't do it. Anyways, check it out, 8bc.org. That's the 8-Bit Collective. Lots of cool 8-Bit songs. I wonder if there's a way to... It'd be cool if you could just make a radio station out of submissions on here. Hey, there's an app. Huh? Check it out.
There's an app idea.
Check it out. Hey, if you guys have any news, a follow-up, or a web application you want us to look at, or a geek tool that you think we should check out, do like Phil did. Let us know on Twitter or Facebook or email. Let us know, and we love to talk about it because, look at this. We got some cool stuff from Phil, and we appreciate his input into the show. So let's get into our topic of the week. This topic is talking about, you're working, you know, with friends, you got this really cool web app idea, and you start programming, and eventually it gets to a point where you gotta go live.
Gotta go live, and not only do you have to go live, you might have to go live, you're gonna be updating the app, you're gonna be constantly deploying new versions of the app, so this isn't just like a big checklist to go live, it's more of the process of how do we take it from our staging or testing development servers to production.
How do we deploy this web app? This week we're talking about deployment.
And I thought it would be kind of nice to start off, at least where we kind of have our show notes here in a progression of, this is kind of where I started, and we'll kind of go through, it's kind of, I would consider the worst way to deploy, basically in an order of kind of the better ways to deploy.
Yeah, and I guess I would say for me, it's, you know, it's sort of a chronological order of my life of how my deployment has evolved. Because
definitely,
you know, when you begin, you start one way, and then you start sort of learning new things, and then eventually you get into some of the really sort of hardcore stuff that we'll talk to later, which is, you know, for deploying, making it really easy and really straightforward. But I started the same way with this first way of deploying right here.
Which is working live right on the production server. It's not really a deployment strategy at all, but
yeah,
it's kind of an anti-deployment strategy.
I mean, it is. Like, let's say you're working on static HTML, you know, do you really need a full-blown deployment? You know, maybe not.
True. So I guess it is. So let's start with the cons, I guess, because there's quite a few of them. Working live, it's kind of slow to see changes. I mean, changes relatively. You know, you make a change to the HTML file. I don't know if you're on the live server or you FTP it directly, but then you have to like refresh the page. That's like maybe 15, 30 seconds. That's a long time when you really look at it. When you go to a local server and you do the same thing, it's like 5 seconds, and you just add those up during a working day, and it begins to be a little bit slower than...
Yeah. Or any other deployment method we have, it's you make all of your changes and then deploy and like pump it up to the live server, right? So, you know, so you see all those changes at once. It's all of your changes, boom. You know, here's an older version, here's the newer one. Working live, it's kind of like you go to one file and you kind of, you know, play around with it. Go to the next file, play around with it. It's, you know, some people might like, well, that's, you know, you could make the argument that's super efficient because not only are you're doing your programming and your deployment at the same time. Well, that's not really true.
a lot of times, especially if you're doing visual design type changes, people could potentially be seeing those changes as you're making them. And, you know, a lot of design changes the layout of the site or whatever. And you know, and if a user's on the site and all of a sudden the navigation's on the right, and then like 5 minutes later it's back to the left, it could be quickly confusing. It's better to, you know, make some changes than push them up live in a lot of cases.
Right. Or
one thing that goes along with that is you could actually break the site if you have like an error or something.
Absolutely.
You could actually break it, and people on the site, you know, they can't.
Yeah,
use it.
You can't tinker around without affecting users. So, you know, you're like experimenting, playing around with the new feature or something, and if you break the whole thing and you don't know what's going on, it's broke till you fix it because it is deployed.
So later we're going to talk about rollbacks, but when you're working live, you typically don't have rollbacks. If you're working live, you probably are not backing up your last like change that you just made 30 seconds ago or 5 minutes ago. So a lot of times when you're working live, you kind of tend to be light-footed and kind of just make little tiny changes and not get drastic and get in there change stuff, which is...
Or you just don't care if you break it, right? It's one of those things you just say, you know, which your choice, but it can make you look bad if people go to your website and it's broken all the time.
The other thing with working live is you don't have a sense of environment. And what I mean by that is like, you don't have like a local server where you've got you don't have Google Analytics. You always have it on. Another one is like email backends. If you're working like on a local server, you can have it not email. You can just have it print to a console or print to a text file or something without sending actual emails out to people.
Right.
When you're working on live, you usually have these types of things in place. Like your email system's already in place, ready to send live emails. And if you start like making fake orders and things, you're generating emails out to people.
Totally.
You know, Google Checkout and PayPal, if you have like shopping carts, these things are usually turned on. And so it's hard to test when you're working live doing these things. Also, error reporting. When you're working live, you often don't have error reporting on, so you don't get to see a lot of the errors. At least you should. And if you don't, then, you know, is this can be a security vulnerability.
Or your development errors are getting mixed with your production errors. So if you have like a development goof up and it's spitting errors out to your error log, but then a customer calls and said, hey, I'm working on my shopping cart and this is an error, then you got to, you know, they're mixed between it. Whereas, you know, if you're using proper deployment, you know, it's like, hey, my production log on my production server is what's happening with my customers. It's not me causing it, you know, developing.
The pros of working live, it's extremely easy to do. The changes are seen instantly. I don't know. This is the way I started, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, you said there is no sense of environment, but also if you're developing live, you're in the environment. It's, you know, that is kind of a pro. It's a lot of sometimes, you know, you can be working in your development environment, and if it is different than your production environment, then it's like, all right, we deploy, and then you go test with your production environment to make sure everything works. You know, those are pretty weak pros compared to all the cons that you have, I think.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you first get into, at least when I first got into web development, I didn't know you could like make your own fake like web server and all this stuff. I thought the host, you know, is the place where you do stuff like this. So, you know, you start doing changes and you quickly find that, well, people are seeing what I'm like, you know, I could potentially make errors and people are seeing it while they're surfing the site. And then you start making maybe like a slash testing folder and you just copy and paste stuff over, right, or you make like a subdomain and that's kind of like working live
dot backup, in a different domain. Yeah. You know, Jay's website dot backup. Yeah. I mean, I guess I should clarify that when I was doing this sort of development, it was with my personal website in the sixth grade. So, you know, I think I'm safe.
So the next kind of strategy is just, you know, FTPing. Maybe you have a local server and then you do some stuff and then you FTP it up.
I call this the control A, control C, control V method of deployment. You know, go to your local folder, select it all, control C to copy it, and then control V it over to the, you know, paste it to the other folder, or with FTP, you know, click to upload to the next one.
Yeah, I mean, FTPing is extremely easy to set up. There's free clients for every OS out there. I don't think you could find a web host that doesn't support FTP. I mean, I don't think there is one. you have complete control over the deployment strategy. You can either push files up or not. You know, you get to choose what versions and what files to put up on the live server and what not to.
Yep.
You know, all the developers pretty much know how to use FTP. It's not very complicated. It's basically like, you know, like you said, copy and paste some folders and it's done.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. But the problems with it is that it's sort of an inefficient use of time. You know, you kind of have to do like the, all right, I got to go do all this. And usually they're not very smart. So like FTP can be not very smart and it'll actually upload everything rather than, you know, being smart about which files were only changed and things like that. The problem also with this sort of deployment is that if you're the first two seem indicative of not using something that we say is very important for developers, which is source control or source control management. So you have the ability to override other people's changes. So this happened a lot. This is what the primary way that we did, or this was how we did deployment when I first started the web industry when I was, you know, a sophomore in high school. Was, you know, we'd work on a person's site and then we'd, you know, copy it all up and FTP it up. And there is definite the ability to erase people's work. So if my boss, you know, pulled the changes down, made some changes and then uploaded them back up, and then I went down and without pulling down his changes, just made changes locally and pushed them back up, boom, his work was gone. And I got in trouble.
I can imagine why.
Yeah. So you got to be careful with that.
Yeah, so I mean, usually with this method, now it's not to say you can't use source code management and still use FTP to deploy it.
Absolutely. But
typically, that's what we usually see when we see people FTPing.
So the next, you know, sort of three or four that we're talking about, they're all the same in that you're doing local development and then using some sort of different transport to push the files up to the server. And that's the deployment, is that, you know, this some sort of transport tool, you have to fire it off and make sure it gets the files up and then manually do what else you need to do.
Yeah, so this next one, we're going to talk about Dreamweaver. I probably was first introduced to this when Microsoft Front Page was kind of popular. You know, you could make some changes and then you could, what they would call publish, which would just basically FTP files up. Dreamweaver, a lot of people use Dreamweaver, and it has a lot of built-in deployment functions. Right. And one of the things that they do is they can actually, when you're deploying, it can actually lock other development, Dreamweaver developers from pushing changes while you're doing it.
Right.
So it helps mitigate a little bit of the overwriting stuff.
Right.
It's kind of like FTPing. I haven't like played with it in a while, so it might have even some more features.
Yeah, I think now it has like some built-in stuff for like, you know, Subversion and simple SEMs, but basically, it's the same thing. It's just you're just firing off the file transfer from your development interface, your IDE. That's really the only big difference for it, right? I mean, it's the same as FTPing, except for Dreamweaver does it for you. It has some other, if everyone's using Dreamweaver, it has some built-in features, like it'll lock stuff out so that other Dreamweaver developers can't. But if you're not, it doesn't. But it really, in the end, it's just you're using Dreamweaver to fire off a file transfer, and that's, you know, the extent of its deployment.
All right, so this next one, rsync, is not necessarily a deployment strategy in and of itself. It's more of a transport layer, kind of like FTP, But the reason we're going to talk about it is it powers a lot of these SCM and other things we're going to talk about. Rsync is a little bit smarter than FTP. If one line in a file is changed, it will only transport that one line and make sure the changes on both sides are synced up. Unlike FTP, where it just says, well, this file's been changed, I'm going to just copy the whole thing over. Yeah. So it's a little bit more efficient on the bandwidth wise. The cons of rsync is it usually requires SSH access. And rsync by itself doesn't really help most people. You need some sort of script to say what version you're in, as if you're using source code management or, you know, it's a big, long kind of command. You don't really want to type it out a lot. Yeah. It usually needs to be scripted and used in conjunction with one of these other things we're going to talk about.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like FTP++. It's smarter. It's leaner. It's more useful. But in the end, yeah, it's just sort of a thing used for transporting files.
So the next thing is source code management, just kind of by itself. Source code management, we talked about, we had an episode all about the different kinds and the different services. But basically, the thing that this brings to the table is built-in rollbacks. So if you, you know, for example, just deploy something and something just goes terribly wrong and it's not working. With SCM, you know, you already have the built-in code. You're not going to overwrite somebody else's code. You can roll back if it failed. And with SCM, it's ready to go. I mean, if you have a public facing SCM or one that's, you know, has a SSH or a key to get to, but as long as it's got like a public URL that the server can get to, you can kind of just pull from that. And that's kind of all you need. I mean, that's for a lot of simple deployments. That's all you need is just to pull down. Right.
I mean,
so you can make like a little script.
For example, for the project we're working on together right now, when I deploy it to our test server, I just get on the test server, I say git pull origin master, and it pulls the newest version, and then after that I do all the other sort of Rails stuff to reset Rails. But you know, yeah, that's what we're doing right now.
So, and then after that you kind of combine all this kind of stuff into a one command deploy. I mean, that's really what we're after. I mean, we don't want to do any manual stuff anymore. Once you get to this level, I want to just type in one little command. I want it to pull all the latest changes. I want it to, if it has to do some database migrations or we'll talk about some of the things you'll want in a deployment script. But
right now, sometimes you know, if I deploy, I forget sometimes maybe to do a database migrate. So I get, you know, I git pull and I restart the server, but then I forget to do the database migrate, and you know, all of a sudden, like, hey, the app isn't working. What's going on? You know, the deployment sort of can get more complex, especially when you start using frameworks and other things like Ruby on Rails or Django. And deployment manually, even with SCM, can be a pain. So what you need is, what also happens is after a while you get like maybe one or two test servers and then a production server. And it's like, you know, let's say you need to deploy to like two test servers. Like if you do any of these other methods, that's a pain. You want these sort of one command to say like deploy to this and deploy to that, or deploy and have it, you know, because these servers, it's all scripting languages. They can communicate and they can do it. So why not have it do it for you?
Yeah. You know, I'm actually going to skip down to what should go in a deployment script, and then we can go back and talk about the different ones. Because it's not just copying some files around at this point. One, maybe you have some unit tests. You want to make sure that somebody didn't like write something in the code that just totally breaks everything, like a syntax error anything.
Totally. Like before you actually deploy, like in your deployment script, you say before you actually move it up to the server, run the test. And if the tests break, don't actually deploy.
Right. You can catch a lot of little, you know, little mistakes that way, or big mistakes. Database migrations, you already talked about that. Why you know, have to go pull all the files and then manually have to SSH in, make sure the database is migrated, or you know, tables or columns are added, or whatever needs to be done there. You know, the deployment script should be able to handle that.
Right.
Environment changes. We kind of talked about these before. This, you know, make sure error reporting is turned off for the production. You know, if you're running SAS or HAML, they probably already do this by default, but you know, make sure that they compile and do their thing, minify the CSS.
Yeah, I mean, they do if I'm using like a Rails plugin, but if I'm just writing this in Sinatra with straight Ruby, then I do need to do that before I deploy. Like I need to actually compile my CSS and stuff from SAS.
Sure, you know, like minify your JavaScript, minify
Absolutely.
Your CSS.
Good call. Minification, totally important for deploying.
You could even do, if you wanted to, if you're into it, you could do the HTML validations or like some simple spell check and stuff, just little things to check to make sure everything's kind of up and going.
Right. So how do I
another
mean,
environment, one more environment changes, you could make sure Google Analytics isn't put in, because you probably don't want Google Analytics on your development server, but you do on your production. So this is where you'd maybe make sure that's put in there somehow.
Yeah, totally. That's a great idea. Yeah. All those are great things. It's funny. Some of these I didn't even think of, but that's a great idea. Because, I mean, sometimes we get spoiled. I mean, I'm using Rails, and plugins do take care of a lot of this stuff. But, like, you know, not everyone's using Rails. A lot of people are using PHP out there, and there isn't a lot of the automation for that stuff, and this is very helpful.
Another one you might want to consider, you should probably be backing up your database, daily or weekly or whatever anyways. But right before a deployment, you know, you could have some users inputting data all the time. So right before you do your deploy, you might have something in your deployment script that backs up your database right then, right before, just in case something goes wrong and your new code like just drops a table or something and you lose just tons of stuff, you know?
Yeah. So one thing too to think about is, I mean, even if you're using SCM and you have the ability to roll back in your SCM, like one of these tools that we're going to talk about called Capistrano, it also not only do you have rollback there, but it also does rollbacks for deploys, which is really nice in that, and other things too, like if you're in a deployment script, you might want to have that while you're deploying. I mean, if you're writing the script, it wouldn't be that hard to do. While I'm deploying, you know, right before I start my deploying, put up a we're working on it page, you know, bear with us, we're going down, a maintenance page due to my deployment, and when my deployment's done, get rid of that maintenance page. Or, you know, like we're saying that one of these tools will do, it'll actually like say like, oh, okay, well, I'll take this previous deployed version, even though it, you know, it doesn't even really have to talk to SCM. It just takes that previous version and sticks it in another folder. You know, it does kind of what we used to do manually through FTP, is like this dot backup and then upload the new one, you know, just in case it breaks, you can just put up the old one really quick. It's something to think about when you're deploying as well.
Yeah, you know, deployment type scripts like Capistrano and these, they're one of those things that it's like version controls. Like once you learn them, you're like, I couldn't imagine why I would ever not use them. But anyway, so Capistrano is a Ruby version of a deployment. Like, well, I mean, how would you describe it? I mean, it's Ruby, just, but it can be used with PHP.
Yeah,
right?
It's written in Ruby, but the whole point is it's supposed to be flexible. It's not just for Ruby on Rails projects. It does all kinds of stuff for you. So like I was saying, for example, by default, it does things like it keeps your previously deployed version up so that you can roll back your deployed version really quick if you did screw up. You can tell it to do Ruby stuff. You can tell it to do PHP or Python stuff. For me, I don't know, from what I've seen is it, what's cool or what it might not be cool about it is Capistrano definitely, it doesn't look like Ruby. It's its own DSL, its domain specific language. So it can be kind of confusing. You won't go to it and go like, oh man, that's Ruby. I recognize it right away. It's very useful. Okay. The next one.
Sure.
Is Vlad the Deployer, which is, I believe, specifically for Ruby on Rails. It uses Rake, but the point with it is it looks like a familiar tool. If you're using Rails, you use Rake, and then so you basically say, like, Rake deploy, and it would know how to do it. But another really cool one is Fabric, and Fabric is a Python project. What's cool about Fabric is it definitely looks like Python. The downside is that in your Python, you're basically running shell commands, so you do have to have shell knowledge.
Mm-hmm. I have actually used Fabric, and it's at least for me, it was a lot like Capistrano, but I did like make my own like rsync command and all that stuff. Nice. So it's like writing Python, but it does a little bit of work for you.
Right.
And then Fing that we saw was more of a build tool, but I did some research, and Fing was the one that was suggested for PHP kind of stuff. But that said, I also saw a lot of people suggesting Capistrano for PHP deployments.
Right. So. And then sort of the home daddy is you can just write your own, like build your own homebrew one, you know, using SSH where you just say pull from repo, do whatever magic you have to, you know, because if you have to do that stuff anyways, you know it, and you can write a bash script to do it for you. either way, think about your deployments, think about how you're doing it, and you know, if you're starting to hit that point where deployments are being a pain, like we're starting to reach in our project, maybe start time to looking at either building your own or looking at some of these tools that will do it for you, because they'll get it done fast and they're pretty fun. And the thing is, once there's, you know, there's sort of a knowledge barrier of learning these deployment tools, but once you sort of get over that barrier, then you'll just, it's really easy to use for different projects, no problem. So that wraps up for this episode of Face Off. I want to thank you guys for listening, and I want to remind you that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can also leave feedback by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Tweet us out, send us an email, anything. Thank you guys for listening, and we will see you next week.